Well, hey, greetings, Internet. I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative professionals and entrepreneurs just like yourself, looking to grow not only by learning new things, but by connecting their work to big ideas and overcoming the barriers that prevent them from doing the work they were born to do. Welcome to episode 169, Limitations, Forgiveness, and Value with Christopher Butler. Chris is a great person to know and learn from. He's a thinker, designer, writer, podcaster, and the chief design officer at Newfangled. If his name sounds familiar, he was on the show last summer, and he has returned to talk about a variety of topics, including the power of limitations in finding creative solutions, how we need to embrace forgiveness of ourselves and others, the changing nature of stories in our lives, and how treating life as a series of small experiments can lead to greater satisfaction. Show notes and links for this episode can be found at gwtw.co/169. Getting Work to Work is brought to you by Chris Martin Studios, a media production company helping creative professionals and entrepreneurs build platforms that connect their work, stories, and mission to their audience. Keep in touch with Chris Martin Studios by signing up for the Curiosity Lab, my weekly email newsletter at gwtw.co/169. All right, I am so ready to get into this conversation with Chris. It was a great time, and I think you're going to learn a lot. So in 3, 2, 1.
Hey man, I've obviously listened to your podcast, but I really appreciated and enjoyed the Beyond Burnout episode that you put up. There's so much in there that one could talk about at length, and so many things I related to as well. Like, man, I've been through burnout cycles of my own, and I thought the way that you were thinking about it seemed pretty healthy. I kind of anticipated that would happen when you, in terms of the going back to your own thing, when you initially said that you wanted to take this job, I wondered how long that's gonna last. You know,
it's just
an interesting thing, because I think once you've been entrepreneurial, it's hard to go back. You know, unless you get that need met some other way within your job. Well, welcome back to the world of entrepreneurship.
Well, to be honest, it's like, okay, where did I go wrong last time? You know, what were the mistakes that I made, and how am I going to actually learn from them this time?
Your dad's question, I think, was apropos. You know, like, what are you going to do different this time? The things you mentioned, I thought were really interesting. I think that dovetail well with the next episode you did. I tend to, for some reason, like, really enjoy your monologue episodes, even more than the interviews, because I think you're naturally good at it, and it's a risky thing to try and do, because I think a lot of people would feel like, oh, it could get really boring really fast. But I think the vulnerability works really well. But in the last one, where you were talking about finally launching a coach service of some kind, and I just really appreciated that you are already thinking, sort of already firing on new cylinders in terms of thinking about how this business is going to be structured differently this time.
Yeah. Well, it's wild to think that way, because, you know, even reading Blair Enns's book, The Win Without Pitching Manifesto, you know, I haven't been able to get the Price and Creativity one yet, but it's like, I mean, just this little book is jam packed full of things that's making me think completely different than, like, I'm going to go make another video for someone. And it's just like, well, that's great, and I like doing that, but it's like, is that enough? And it's like, it's a race to the bottom, in my opinion.
Yeah. And it's such a challenge. I mean, you're talking about a creative service that has been commoditized to a fairly significant degree. The thing is, like, you, and also, I don't want to derail your your agenda for this, but, and we might even want to talk about some of these things today, but I, you know, the positioning element you were talking about, figuring out your focus and your expertise. And, you know, you can have a very generalist horizontal positioning, you know, that is inclusive of all kinds of things that one might say has been commoditized. Mm-hmm. So long as the vertical positioning is tight, and vice versa. You can have no vertical positioning so long as the horizontal is extremely tight. Mm-hmm. And I've seen both models work really, really well, and have, you know, helped and coached many of my clients to figure that decision out. But it's interesting, like, you know, you and I have both worked in areas of production where the thing that we're delivering has become incredibly commoditized. I mean, yeah. You couldn't go lower, mm-hmm. but that doesn't mean you never do them again.
Right. Can you explain a little bit about the difference between horizontal and vertical?
Yeah, so that was the first thing that popped into my head when I was listening to your episode, where you talked about expertise and positioning, because the first thing to think about when you're thinking about a creative audience, which is probably the type of person that you and I would speak to most often, mm-hmm. that the idea of specialization is anathema right off the bat. And that's mostly because people like us have gotten into this field because we really value novelty. Mm-hmm. We really value experiencing new things and the feedback loop that's created by experiencing a new thing, learning from it, trying something out, and, you know, being able to sort of gain a proficiency in something while letting ourselves be inundated by outside factors, right? That's sort of like the designer's dream.
Right.
And the idea of specialization feels like you're taking that away. And I've noticed with many, many, many of my clients, they are terrified of specialization because they're afraid of getting bored in yeah. the long run. I mean, that's one side. And the other side is they're afraid of market factors that they might become subjected to. So they say, well, if I choose this, what if 5 years down the line, the market doesn't value that anymore and I'm stuck?
Yeah.
So I generally actually think that risk is much lower than people think. They're using that business context to sort of be the beard for the fear of loss of novelty, really, because that's, I think, what people are most afraid of. And that's where the conversation about differentiating between vertical and horizontal is really important. So horizontal positioning has to do with the what. So positioning is you do this for them. Right? I do blank for blank. Mm-hmm. Think of it like a Mad Lib.
Yeah.
Horizontal is filling in the what, and vertical is filling in the who.
Yeah.
Right? Now, it doesn't always have to be that literal. For instance, a vertical doesn't necessarily have to be a type of person or even a named industry vertical. It could be a context. For instance, lawyers tend to have vertical positioning that's contextual, right? So it's a specialization in a type of law that's applicable to certain people, certain contexts, certain types of scenarios, certain interactions between people in whatever jurisdiction, right? Mm-hmm. So you don't always have like, okay, I'm a lawyer for manufacturing. It might be something other than that. That's why, you know, there's all kinds of different types of law and they're contextually specific, not necessarily person specific or industry specific. So a vertical could be manufacturing, but it also could be some kind of contextual situation. For instance, I'm working with a client now where their horizontal positioning is e-commerce, right? So they're a mm-hmm. technologically driven, basically an engineering firm that does e-commerce applications, but their vertical positioning in regard to the context is they basically rehab existing e-commerce systems and tune them up in a very particular way. Nice. So they don't want to work necessarily with people who are building something from the ground up. They want to rescue a division that has experienced pitfalls A through C and are really poised to get the best value out of this firm's expertise.
Wow,
so
that's awesome.
that's one way where you can do, you know, your primary positioning is horizontal, but you have a secondary vertical that gets you into a very particular context. On the other hand, you could have a very general positioning on the horizontal, like marketing, mm-hmm. but your context is really specific to a type or recipient that has very specific problems. And the more you work with them, the more you understand those problems so you can anticipate them, come up with the best solution to them. So you might be marketing for healthcare. And even that, healthcare is so broad as a vertical that may not be adequate today. It might be required that if you're going to be so, you know, marketing sounds specific, but it's not, and healthcare mm-hmm. sounds specific, it's really not. You might need to be a certain kind of marketing, like you might actually just be outbound email marketing for a certain subcategory of healthcare. That would be very, very tight on both sides. So does that make sense? The difference between vertical and horizontal?
It does. And I appreciate you kind of illuminating that, because one of the things that I think people struggle with in defining these things is like, the business world likes to speak in abstract terminology. And I think the creative world, they like abstract terminology in their own way, but get a little bit lost sometimes when it comes to things like, well, what do you mean by horizontal? What do you mean by vertical? What do you mean by all this stuff? And then instead of like asking those questions and trying to apply it to what they're doing, they just kind of ignore it and be like, I'll just figure out what I'm going to do on my own.
Right.
And waste so much time.
Well, right. Because there's nothing more off-putting to someone who's trying to learn something than jargon, because jargon is basically shorthand for people who have already established a shared vocabulary. So you can get to meaning faster by using jargon. But if you don't know, if you don't understand the concept of positioning, then further defining it with these sort of terms that are somewhat opaque, like vertical and horizontal, does not help. That's why I think if you're listening to this and you're thinking about trying to improve the likelihood of success in your business in the future, right? You want to get more opportunity mm-hmm. and do better work. You pointed out, Chris, in your last episode, it's not just about getting rich. It's about doing really good work on your terms, mm-hmm. right? So if you want to do that, you're more likely to gain success by getting very specific about what you do. That's what positioning is being as specific as possible about what you do. And that has to do with what you do, right? So you might be very nonspecific. You might just say, well, I'm a designer, mm-hmm. right? That could manifest in so many ways, right. But you could say, I work really, really well in these conditions. So it might be, I understand healthcare. I've worked within healthcare for my entire career. So I understand the ins and outs. I even understand how something as complicated as HIPAA compliance might apply to the decisions and recommendations that I make. So therefore I'm really positioned well to help people within healthcare with my tools. But you might even say, and actually specifically, I've worked more with HMOs, so I understand the sort of Byzantine nature of their bureaucracy. Whereas, you know, I'm not going to actually market to a general practitioner, independent GP in a town. So I'm not marketing to doctors, I'm marketing to organizations that structure how healthcare is wielded within a government or a closed private system. So that would be just like one example of where you go from, forget the jargon and just think about specificity. Mm-hmm. It's not like when someone says or challenges a designer to figure out their specialization, it's meant to be pulled out of thin air.
Yeah.
Right. It's really critical that you look at what am I really good at? Right. What do I enjoy doing? And where's our opportunity? Mm-hmm. In fact, I actually have a sort of schema for this that I use when I work with my clients, which I call the ideal client inquiry. So most of our clients at Newfangled are in the process of becoming even more specific about what they do, narrowing mm-hmm. their position. Many of them start from a very established and specific vertical and horizontal position, but they want to increase that even more. And because we work with them on marketing, our general perspective is the tighter your position from an expressed marketing standpoint, the more you can craft a marketing plan that's even more measurable than before and more effective. It's just more targeted. Yeah. So positioning on the business side has to also equate to a very firmly stated position on the marketing side. So I'll say to them, listen, let's do the ideal client inquiry, which means let's look back on your portfolio of work, right? As long as the business has existed. And where have you made the most money, had the greatest impact, and enjoyed the work the most? So if you envision a Venn diagram, it's that nexus of impact, profit, and pleasure, right? And whichever client sits on the inside is representative of where you're, at least to date, positioning ought to be. And that can be really illuminating, because a lot of times you might sit down with a group of people at a table and say, hey, what is your firm best at? And you'll get six different answers. But right. that might be because someone's discounting the profit, someone else is discounting the impact, someone else is discounting the pleasure. You know, typically, someone who's not involved in delivery might discount pleasure because they don't experience what it's like to work with that client and do the work. Someone who's not involved on the leadership side might discount profit because they just don't even know.
Yeah.
So that's why you have to look at all three of those places and say, that's the unique ability of the firm, and therefore that needs to translate to positioning.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And what I appreciate you speaking to right now is you're speaking to this journey of you have to start somewhere, but you have to continually progress from this idea of where am I at and where am I going, and continually making those decisions and those changes so that you can increase, I think, the search for the intersection of those three things.
Exactly. I mean, nobody's career or life is static, right? Every day is informed by the day that preceded it.
Yeah.
And so if you think about that ideal client inquiry, for instance, one could do that on a quarterly basis, on a yearly basis, and continually steer the ship. It's kind of interesting that it's a Venn diagram because it's a circular motif, right? Mm-hmm. And then you envision your career, or if it's an organization behind you, your organization as the ship. And you're just slowly steering that ship by continually getting around that Venn diagram and thinking, okay, well, let's look at the profit side right now. Let's look at mm-hmm. the impact side. And you constantly ask that question, and it will cause you to make these micro adjustments as you move forward. In fact, it might mean that you define what it is you do, that specific thing, your positioning, and you find a way to articulate that positioning, mm-hmm. right? And by doing the ideal client inquiry, that will cause you to make these micro adjustments in wording, right? It might not yeah. change the fundamental meaning, but it might make it more effective as a message. And that's another thing that inquiry is it can be used for, is not just to illuminate what your positioning should be, assuming a context in which you do lots of different things for lots of different people, but it will also help you identify who should give you the feedback as you make adjustments.
Yeah.
And that's critical. If you are thinking about making a change to your business and changing how you articulate that, how you put that message out into the world, you must get out of your own blind spot and get to that ideal client and say, hey, this is what I'm thinking about putting out there. This is how I'm describing what it is that we've done for you. Does this sound like what you experienced? Does the way I describe you in the abstract, does that sound like how you describe yourself? And you need to be able to ask those questions of the right people at mm-hmm. the right times. And this is definitely not a one-time thing. This should be a routine discipline that you might do as an individual or as a business, perhaps even once a year.
Yeah. Well, I think you just touched on something very important too when it comes to going from just being a creative who does something for money and a creative who is building a business. And it's mm-hmm. this idea of routine discipline. And that seems to be two words put together that can scare the shit out of a creative.
Routine and discipline.
Yes, exactly.
Oh yeah, because it feels like boundaries.
Yeah.
And what I've noticed, tracing all the way back to when I went to art school, so 15 years ago when I graduated art school, is that creatives have this mistaken, they have this idea that limitations are a negative influence on creativity. And what I've observed at every step along the way since 1998, when I enrolled in art school, up until now, 2018, 20 years later, is that the opposite. At every single step, it's that limitations actually promote the most effective creative solutions. They make you think better about mm-hmm. what it is that you're going to do. And usually it's because it gives you fewer options to try and fewer things to glom onto emotionally. Because that's ultimately what happens. When you have the most choice in front of you, you'll make a choice based more on emotions than when you have fewer options. When you have fewer options, you start to think more practically about what you're choosing. You don't have the luxury of aligning yourself immediately on the basis of emotion.
Mm. as you're talking about emotion and all of these kind of limitations and boundaries, I'm thinking of something that I wrote down from the Win Without Pitching manifesto. I'll paraphrase it, but it's just something that Blair wrote that said, "Stress is avoiding what you know you need to do."
That's true, because our minds are really, really powerful. We see what's coming. And it creates anxiety, mm-hmm. you know? I also tie that to something that you said in the episode that I referenced earlier when you were talking about burnout. You were talking about how an indicator of your burnout was that you started taking things more personally than you mm-hmm. should. And what another way of saying that is that when you're depleted of energy, you will find your need to gravitate towards things emotionally more because you're not getting that need met, right? Mm-hmm. You have a deficit. Another way of stating that is, and this is so crucial for people like us who work in the quote unquote creative field, is we must find a way to satisfy the needs of our ego outside of how we get paid.
Yes.
We have to do that. It doesn't mean that that there can't be any overlap. It just means that fundamentally we all have egos and they're all desperately hungry for food, for validation, emotional yeah. validation all the time. And we have to acknowledge that, accept it, and find healthy ways to feed it so that we don't end up feeding it in unhealthy ways. If you don't find a way to feed it, that means that every meeting you're in, you're going to try and be the smartest person in the room and try and suck up all the air and try and control the outcome. But on the other hand, if you have your ego fed properly, well, maybe you'll sit back and listen to someone else's idea and be able to see that it's actually better than the one that you had and that it might have even been surprising in some way. Mm-hmm. And you might say, you know what? The best thing for me to do with my energy right now is help promote that person's idea, not necessarily the thing that I came in here that I was predisposed to think was best.
Yeah, that's awesome. What are some ways that you feed your ego?
Oh my gosh, so many. It's ravenous. Well, I will say you mentioned meditation in among the things that you were doing to move forward differently this time with your business. And you also mentioned therapy. By the way, I thought it was really interesting that you kind of you expected that most people would find therapy shocking. Like, yeah. You know, this therapy thing is negative. I was on a panel a number of years ago, and a question came in that said, what's one of the most important things a creative person can do that would give them the soft skills they need to succeed? And, you know, what the questioner was trying to get around is like, it's not about learning to code. It's not about learning this trade or going to this event. And other people had other answers. When it got to me, I said, therapy. Therapy is probably the most important thing you can do because it acknowledges the person within, not the suit that we put on as designers mm-hmm. or as professionals. It acknowledges the person that has the narrative, the hurts and the fears and the desires and the wonder and the childhood. You know, we trace it all the way back to birth, and we have to acknowledge that we are complicated and very, very complex emotional organisms. And so therapy is really critical because it starts to help you understand the emotion that is contributed to what you think is a very logical way of life. Hmm. Most people make emotional decisions that they don't realize are emotional. And so I think therapy at its base, it's not meant to be this thing where you sort of go into this inevitable cesspool of all of your, you know, it's not meant to be an endless psychoanalysis, you know. It's the approach that I've experienced has been cognitive behavioral therapy, which is mm-hmm. about understanding why you think the way you think and trying to rebuild a different path. So therapy, great. Meditation, also great, because you mentioned starting the day with meditation, and I can say from my own experience that meditation is probably one of the best things that I've ever done to regulate how my emotions play out the rest of the day. Mm. And I don't really have any scientific analysis to prove this, but an analogy I can draw is that something I learned about diet a number of years ago. If you start the day by eating a bowl full of Tricks or Fruity Pebbles, or, you know, I haven't eaten cereal in so long that I'm like talking about cereals that were like from my childhood, but, you know, the Frosted Flakes or something like that.
Right.
What you end up doing is you spike your blood sugar level first thing in the day, and the rest of the day, your body tries to recapture that spike. right? Otherwise you crash. Yeah. So you're setting the level too early on the basis of sugar, and that will end up creating worse decisions for you dietarily moving forward. So that's why, like, if you talk to anyone who is thinking about nutrition and weight loss and all that sort of thing, they'll talk about food choices, especially first food choices. And the same thing goes for meditation. How do you start the day first? If you start the day first by opening up your Twitter feed or your Facebook feed, and all of a sudden you're like full of all these sort of reactive emotions, you know, envy, regret, comparison, FOMO, all that stuff, then you're going to spend your whole day making decisions based upon that immediate emotional experience. Mm-hmm. You might make a decision that is completely unrelated to how you felt about your high school girlfriend posting pictures of their child or something, something bizarre like that. But they actually are directly related because of your emotional response. So start the day off by clearing your head and focusing on just a physiological process of breathing and regulating the way that your body responds to mind, even for 5 minutes, will change. It will have this sort of butterfly effect on every other emotional response you have for the rest of the day.
Hmm. One of the things that I'm challenged with recently is just, you know, when we're talking about meditation, therapy, burnout, regeneration, all of these things, is the word practice. Mm-hmm. And I like the idea of practice in describing our business, our work, our life, because it's not static, it's dynamic, but it requires this daily intention to actually do things that matter, that can be improved upon.
Especially if they're small.
Yeah.
You know, a principle that has popped up everywhere in my life in the last handful of years is the accruing of dividends from small investments, you mm-hmm. know, and you even, again, to echo and validate something you said in a previous episode, making small moves on a regular basis will end up generating more impact and more movement than what you think of as these grand, big steps that you might take from time to time. Hmm. It's kind of like the same principle with exercise. If you exercise once a week, you know, you do this sort of weekend warrior thing, but the other 6 days of the week, you don't move and you eat poorly, then it's not going to change anything. But if you do a little bit every day, you're going to get further because it's one, more sustainable, but two, it's consistent mm-hmm. and you're building a new system of existence. So practice is really critical, and it doesn't, again, meditation, it doesn't need to be, you know, sitting there for 45 minutes. It can be five.
Yeah.
I think you mentioned, what's the app that you use?
Headspace.
Headspace. And yeah. From what I understand, I've never used it, but from what I understand, it begins there. It wants you to start small, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you can actually choose the settings of the duration. So for example, if you've just got 5 minutes, you dial in 5 minutes. If you want to do a little bit longer, you can do like 10, 15. And the pack I'm on is about managing anxiety. And mm-hmm. I think the max length is 20 minutes. And mm-hmm. they're all pretty much structured the exact same way. I mean, you start with breathing, you check in with your body, you check in with, you know, how you're feeling, reminding yourself why you're doing it. And then you spend probably 15 minutes just focused on your breathing, and anytime some thoughts come in, at least in this pack, you label it whether I'm thinking or feeling. So, and then you move back to your breathing. So it's like, oh, I'm just thinking, or I'm feeling anxiety. Okay, back to the breathing. And it seems really basic, but it's so hard because sometimes you want to do a really good job, but in meditation, performance isn't the objective. It's awareness. And right. that difference, performance versus awareness, is a game changer, I think, for the creative world.
Yeah. And no matter what context, I think we always overestimate our own awareness of how we think, what we think about, what we do. And so something like meditation, which, you know, most people who begin training in that, and I consider myself barely a beginner because I'm still very much enthralled with the challenge of just trying to clear my mind and getting good at dismissing yeah. thought as that comes through. that's really critical, is you're sitting there and you're focusing on your breathing, and you then will find suddenly that you're thinking about something, some work thing or some home thing. You're like, oh, I got to fix that, or I got to clean the gutters or whatever it is. And then you say, oh yeah, okay, that's fine. Let's set that aside. Mm-hmm. And you have to get good at sort of swatting those mind flies away gently, without judgment, without saying, oh, I suck at this, I might as well just stop. Mm-hmm. And that never stops. I mean, I've been doing this for a few years, and I've gotten good at sitting for longer periods of time, and I'm getting a lot of benefit from it when I do it. But it's never the case that I'm sitting there and I'm instantly, you know, clear of mind for the entire time.
Yeah.
The entire time is about acknowledging and accepting that things pop into your head that you didn't consciously want to come up. Mm-hmm. And you can set them aside. You don't have to go down each path that your mind presents to you.
I'm laughing because as you're describing, I'm like, oh, this is like Twitter manifested in our brains.
Exactly. Oh, and that's why social media is so dangerous, because it almost validates a negative way that your brain can work, because our brains are incredibly porous to outside input. Mm. Whether it's, you know, listening to music or podcasts or looking at the internet or watching television or having a phone in your pocket that is just basically all the world's information available to you at one swipe, you know, our minds will take as much as we can give them. But they won't give back to us. That's the problem. Mm. And so, yeah, Twitter's a great analogy, because Twitter never stops. The more open you are to Twitter, the more it will take over your attention. And your brain is structured exactly that same way. So without some sort of governance, you know, you won't get any value out of it. You know, Twitter, for instance, without filters and muting and lists, is pretty useless. Mm-hmm. And the same thing goes for your brain. Your brain without governance, some sort of discipline and control, is also at danger of being useless.
So how do you approach this idea of limitations, boundaries, and governance with your mind? I mean, where do you start with something like that?
Yeah, well, that's going to be pretty personal to a lot of people in terms of what things they feel like are more beneficial or not so to them. For instance, I guess I might start with a question of what things do I do regularly that that end up provoking negative emotions from me? So for instance, I am not on Facebook, and I have all sorts of reasons for that are external, right? Mm-hmm. Things that company has done that make me feel like they are not worthy recipients of my time and attention and my information. So mm-hmm. that's easy to state. But I also have to say that if I were on Facebook, I would spend way too much time thinking about how my life compares with what I think is being portrayed about other people's lives on that platform. And I knew, even before I built my sort of political case for getting off of Facebook, I knew that Facebook was not a positive influence in my life. So if someone asked me, hey, think through the things that you encounter day to day voluntarily that don't contribute to positive thought or energy in your life, Facebook would be definitely in the top. But it's also about like how I spend my time or when I do certain things. I've had all kinds of phases of my life just in the last handful of years where I start to tweak how I take in information. That's ultimately what it's about for me, is what are the sources of information, what kind of information is it, and when do I allow it in? Mm. And so when you talk about like, well, how do I sort of deal with this issue in my life, it tends to be a constantly ongoing experiment of, you know, adding and removing things and pruning here and there and trying to be intentional about when I do things and what and the things that I'm doing. So I guess actually I've gotten to that sort of answer. It's intentionality at all times. So that doesn't mean I will say to you today that there's a certain thing I will never, ever do again, or a thing I will do every day for the rest of my life. But I will say that I will always be intentional about what information's coming in, for instance, or things that I might do first thing in the day, mm-hmm. Or other ways I might spend my time, because I know that just thinking about that and questioning whether or not something has value or contributes value in my life is more important than making a judgment about any discrete thing. It's kind of an Amish approach. Like, right, most people have sort of, they think that the Amish approach is just anti-technology, right? Mm-hmm. So, okay, the Amish, they accept wheels, but they don't accept engines. They accept buttons, but they don't accept zippers. You know, they live this sort of like 19th century lifestyle. And that's actually not true. It isn't the case that the Amish just got to a point and said, okay, no more. The Amish approach to governance is to say, does this new thing, whether it's an idea, a tool, a technology, does it create value for the community? Mm. And it can't just be answered individually. So that will cause them to take in new technologies. And they have moved the line. So it's not the case that, you know, it was just wool and no further. I mean, the Amish wear a lot of polyester, you know, and that's a technological fabric. What they always are asking is, let's try this thing out. Let's decide as a group whether or not it benefits our community. And so that might mean that they try things out for a while and you might say, oh my God, that Amish person's on a cell phone, a hypocrite. No, they might actually just be questioning whether or not it benefits their community. So I have seen Amish people riding in motor vehicles. I've seen Amish people using cell phones. And that's because their approach to this is an ongoing question of, does this thing bring value, shared value? Yeah. And that may be true for a time. It may be true to an individual, but not for the group. And they constantly have to weigh on those things.
It's interesting because as you're describing the community and the group, it speaks to this idea of business and understanding your group and your community, whether it's your employees or other business owners or the people that can help you to bring that value to the group so that it becomes valuable. So how have you approached this idea of leaving the self behind and being comfortable in self so that you can be present in a group without ego overtaking?
Right, right. Well, I mean, I think the dream is that you could do that all the time. And I think I've yet to experience that. I'm definitely still quite imperfect as per my own evaluation. there's so many times where I'm like, oh man, you know, that does not line up with how I thought I would be in that scenario or how I intended to be. Mm-hmm. So that's just important to stay first and foremost. You can be as intentional as you want, but as far as I can tell, we are all equally subjected to the sort of unpredictability of what's going to come at you and the sort of chaotic nature of what's outside of ourselves, not to mention what's in. So we can go in with the best of intentions. We can build these systems of governance for ourselves. We can be as thoughtful and intentional and as zen, quote unquote, zen as possible, but we're going to slip up and screw up. And so number one, we have to be forgiving of one another and ourselves. And that's something like, especially now in 2018, we've been through the ringer over the last couple of years. It doesn't matter if you're American or not listening to this, things are weird right now. And one thing that makes it worse, where it goes from weird to worse, is when we don't have the ability to be forgiving of one another and ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that increases tribalism, that increases violence, that increases hatred. All kinds of negative things come from that. So I want to say at the outset that this is a difficult thing, but I think if we were all engaging in it with the same point of view insofar as our own engagement with the world, not sort of political opinions or social opinions, we would be more forgiving of one another. So that and ourselves, because we're going to screw up and we're going to harm one another. So other than that, refresh, sorry, what was the question?
Well, the question was just like, how do you move from self to be embracing group and community? And before we jump back into that, I want to, what you were saying about just tribalism and all these things. I've been watching this show on Netflix called Ugly Delicious. Mm-hmm. And the host is David Chang of Momofuku.
Yeah.
I think. Anyway, he really looks at different foods and the social and political implications of those foods. Mm-hmm. And it's been fascinating to watch and just be challenged with the conceptions and misconceptions that something as simple as food can bring to self and group and community. It's fascinating. I don't know if you've heard of that show.
I watched the one episode, I think it was about fried rice.
Yes.
And yeah, because my wife and I will definitely watch some food porn. although we gravitate towards things like this or things like Bourdain because they tend to be about exposing you to other cultures and other ways of life. And, you know, I find it really fascinating to feel like, oh my gosh, I feel like I was on that street. That's an incredible experience. But yeah, food, of course, because food is such an, it's a physiological extension of our worldview, right? We don't just make food to look at, we make food to eat.
Yeah.
And so it engages all of our senses. And yet it's also an expression of who we are as a group and as individuals. So I can definitely see that. So your question, how do you engage being mindful of all of these things? That I don't know that there is a way with a capital W. I think I can talk about things that have been important to me. I mentioned therapy already, and I can't really underscore the value of that because it's not like I was crazy at any point or even especially dysfunctional. You mentioned anxiety a few moments ago. I would, if someone were to ask me, well, what has been the struggle for you? I would say, well, that's been it. I've not struggled with depression generally. I've struggled with anxiety. And one way I've sort of differentiated between those two things is like, you know, when you struggle, do you have a hard time getting out of bed or do you have a hard time staying in bed? And for me, it's the latter. Anxiety causes me to be hyper performative. And meanwhile, I have this noise going on in my mind of all of the other stuff, the worries, the fears, the lies, the internal monologue of you're not good enough. You're a charlatan, you're a fraud. You're on the brink of failure, et cetera. You know, things that I think anyone listening would be acquainted with. So therapy has helped me to manage that, as have all kinds of other practices like meditation. A third thing that jumps out to me that's really, really big is family. And for me, I want to use the word family generally because I can trace between relationships that I have with my immediate family, my parents, my siblings, my wife, as well as now our daughter, all of the work that's required to make those relationships healthy and good is an enormous amount of energy. And if you spend that energy because you value those relationships, that is energy you don't have to spend on other things, like things that you might otherwise classify as unproductive narcissism or, you know, too self-absorbed or whatever. And so I would not say that, like, you know, those people who have children are poised to be better at this than others, because that's not true. But I would say that intentionally building relationships can be a major contributor to a well-balanced life. So whether that's your partner, your spouse, your immediate family, or a child, or just friends, thinking about how you can give of yourself to others and really give of yourself to others outside of a business context will totally change the landscape, the emotional landscape of your life, because it requires intimacy and that requires vulnerability. You can't be intimate with someone without being vulnerable, and you can't be vulnerable with someone without examining all of your innermost fears and anxieties. That's what vulnerability is. It's exposing oneself to somebody else. But what that gives to you in terms of support and in terms of the actual intimacy that you would have with somebody else, the sense of belonging is unlike anything else. So when I think about, you know, therapy, meditation, and family, I've spent the last 2 decades of my life trying to be as investment-oriented in relationships as I possibly can. I have a really big family. I have 6 siblings and 4 parents because both my parents were divorced and got remarried when I was quite young. So, and it's spread all over the place, and that requires a lot of work. Attending to all those relationships where people are living hundreds, if not thousands, of miles from one another. And now I have another set of family with my wife's family, and investing in those relationships. It's not easy. It takes a lot of energy. And now we have a daughter, and that, above all, for me, has tipped the scales, because suddenly, and this is big for me, suddenly there's a person in my life who needs me more than any of these other people have ever needed me or probably will ever need me. And therefore, I have to give of myself in a completely different way, a completely unrestrained comparatively. Another way of looking at this is like we live our lives and we think of ourselves as the protagonist of the story, right? So there's this story, the Chris Martin story, and you're the protagonist. And you've got a cast of characters that are pretty up there. If you were to like cast that movie, you'd put important people in those roles, right? Mm-hmm. But then for me, all of a sudden, a year and a half ago, this other story popped up. My daughter's story, and she's the protagonist of her story. I'm a side player. I'm a supporting role, and her story, in theory, is going to last longer than mine, right? My story is going to end, and hers is going to continue. And so all of a sudden, I have to stop thinking of myself purely as the protagonist of my own story. I have to think of myself as the supporting player of hers. And that demands a different perspective on everything I do in my life, particularly now because she's a toddler and, you know, toddlers require constant attention. Yeah. But that really shifted my focus in so many ways, even to the practical where I used to go to the gym 6 days a week. Now I only go two. And it's worked for me. It hasn't ruined my body or my life. In fact, it's actually made me get more value out of the time I go. But I do that because I need that time to invest in this relationship, in this life. And so that's just one example of the thousands of ways that becoming a parent has changed. But again, I want to say, I don't want anyone listening to this to misconstrue what I'm saying, that like parenting is a great way. Mm-hmm. It's a way.
Yeah.
If I didn't have a child, I probably would be talking about my relationship with my wife or my family and friends just as much.
Well, it sounds like it's this move away from thinking of your life as a single spectrum of birth to death. And instead, so like a food chain approach almost, where you can trace, you know, who eats whom, you know, for sustenance, to moving to that more food web, to see the larger picture and how, you know, when you're the protagonist of your story, but a supporting character in another, and you start seeing all these intersections of timelines and ideas, it creates this lattice of connectivity. And it's all moving and pulling against each other, towards each other at any given time. And it's just like, that's complicated. Yeah. That's hard. And it's just like, I think sometimes the more you can embrace that, you'll move faster in directions that you never imagined than if you try to fight it and put your feet into the ground and, you know, get pulled apart, ripped apart by all these emotions or feelings, or I don't know. I don't know where I'm going with that, but like, I'm just thinking of just submitting to this motion and this movement of embracing the stories that you're connected to.
Yeah. And that will make you a better friend, sibling, child, parent, but also a better partner in business, mm-hmm. a better designer for those people who are listening. You know, something that really impacted me when I was 10 years ago, even before that, is I got really interested in the life of Buckminster Fuller. Mm. And for those people who don't are not aware of him listening, he was, I guess, an inventor. That's one way you could describe him, an architect. Who lived basically until he died in the 80s, but he was, you know, he lived the first half of the century. He was very active during that time. And he came from a very interesting background, a sort of transcendentalist background. In fact, his grandmother is a big name in the sort of late 19th century transcendentalist movement in the United States. So he has this interesting philosophical / religious background. But anyway, he comes from a pedigree. He came, you know, a lot was expected of him. And he didn't do so well in school. He was sort of lacking in discipline, too weird a thinker, definitely not. He was not conventional in any way. And he got to being about 30 and he felt like his life had not amounted to anything and would not. Now look, I'm 38 and I just turned 38 yesterday.
Oh, and happy birthday.
Thank you. And now I look at that and say, well, wow, that's a lot. That's way too early to make that judgment. But 30 in the 30s was different than 30 is today in terms of people's expectations for longevity. But in any event, he got to that age and was hopeless. He considered suicide. He considered ending it. He had a wife and children at the time. And then he thought to himself, well, okay, if I'm really at the bottom of the barrel, if I'm really that hopeless, then I don't have anything to lose by treating my life like an experiment instead. I could end it, I could just call it quits, or I could treat it like an experiment, right? What could I do with my life now if I just treated it that way? And that's such a fascinating shift in perspective that I've thought about at so many junctures of my own life where I felt defeated or hopeless, because I've thought to myself, well, if I'm really that hopeless, if I've really, really reached this sort of abject point, this abject bottom, then I have nothing to lose by trying something else out. And what's amazing about Buckminster Fuller's life is that everything that he's done of impact came after that point. And they are profound things. For those people who aren't aware, he came up with the sort of structural Fullerene, which is based on his exploration of these geodesic domes. So if you've ever seen the geodesic dome at Epcot Center, that's mm-hmm. his design. But he's also done many, many other things that people have probably seen or heard about. And, you know, wild guy, I think really cutting edge for his time and still impactful today. And all that stuff came after his understanding of, okay, what if I treated my life as an experiment? And in fact, on his tombstone, he uses a word to describe himself that he used a lot in life, which is trim tab, T-R-I-M-T-A-B. And the trim tab is kind of the rudder's rudder on a boat. It's this little flexible tab that's cut into the rudder of a boat, and it senses changes in current in a very sensitive way before the rudder does, and it helps adjust courses. And so he thought of his life as being the trim tab. Wow. And that touches back to what you were talking about small things, small investments. He's saying, if I can do these little small things, they could have a big impact. So not being the rudder, I'm not trying to control something. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to contribute to the direction that this other thing is going, whether it's the world, the community, his life, et cetera.
Mm. That's awesome. So if you were to put one word on your tombstone, Chris, what would you put on there?
Oh man, I would go with no words before I could choose one. The word that keeps coming up in my head, that always has as an adult, is kind of a funny one for me because, for those of you listening who subscribe to the podcast, you'll see this in the title. But my last name is Butler, right? Like the servant. And I'm not trying to be falsely humble in this, but service and serving has been important to me my whole life. And the older I get, the more fascinated I am by the connection to that and my last name. Because again, I had no connection to my last name. No one in my family has ever been a butler. You know, perhaps way back in, you know, the 15th century, that the name evolved from the name for a bottler in a established home, like a butler. And so clearly somebody in the origins of the name was that. But yeah, I've never had any connection to that, but service has mattered to me. And I can trace that to all the relationships that I want to build in. I want to be a contributor to good in those people's lives. So service could just mean being a good listener mm-hmm. at times, or giving of myself. But also I like to be generous with my family and friends, but I also just like to do service oriented work. And most of the time, and this is a great indicator of where your emotional health is, I feel more myself and satisfied when I'm doing really grunt labor, futile grunt labor, like cleaning a toilet or cleaning the house, than I do when I'm doing something for which I know I'm going to get credit later. Mm. You know, when I do work that later the credit looks like either money or acclaim, or, you know, just somebody thinking that I'm smarter, you know, than maybe I actually am, that's all nice, but it doesn't actually affirm me internally. In fact, and I can tell the difference in my body. Mm. I can't really describe it that well verbally, but there is a feeling that I have when I'm, you know, cleaning my house, and I'm my wife is the groundskeeper of our home, and I'm the butler of the house, and I feel satisfaction in doing that. Not even when it's done, but in doing it, I feel more me in that moment than I do when I'm doing the thing for which I'm paid. It doesn't mean I feel like an alien in that context, but man, there's something about that really has is part of who I am at the innermost core of who I am. So I guess service maybe, but I also don't want to claim that it's been effective. So I'd probably be inclined to just have no words at all. I don't know. That's a hard question.
Well, I just appreciate the way that you've shown up in my life when I have questions, or even just the way that you show up in the conversations that we have. And I just thank you for your time today, you know, sharing deep personal insights with the Getting Work to Work audience. So thank you so much for your time today, Chris.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me. And I thank you in turn for this podcast, because I've referenced a couple of episodes along the way. It doesn't really matter where you are in your career or your life. Nobody's beyond being taught and beyond soaking up something of value from someone else. And what you're offering in terms of your willingness to vulnerably outward process on these episodes and inquire your curiosity is great. It doesn't matter who you are. I mean, I've learned a ton and have been pointed in all sorts of directions of thought just by listening to the way that you do what you do. So this is something that everybody can be a trim tab in someone else's life, I guess is a way to put it. It doesn't matter who you are, how big your audience is, how many people know who you are, or even how loud your voice is. I think it doesn't really matter. In fact, it's better that you don't know. Mm-hmm. It's better that you just speak from the heart with whatever platform you may or may not have.
Yeah. It's funny. I read this article. It was an interview with David Lynch, and he was describing how things changed from when he was a nobody to who he is now. And he's like, it's easier when you're a nobody and you don't have anything, because all the time is yours to make whatever you want to do. He goes, it just gets more complicated the more you're known.
Well, and the experience is less mediated by subtext. So this is actually, it's funny you mentioned this, because I just got back from a visit with some family in Detroit, and my brother-in-law and I were talking about a possible career change for him. And he's passionate about baseball. So we were standing in my parents' backyard playing catch, baseball mitts, nice. You know, very classic. And we're talking about this, and what I said to him, because he's really, his career will have nothing to do with this, but we're talking about baseball players. And I was saying, you know, it's amazing to me. Imagine being that player that you're talking about, who, you know, has this multi-million-dollar contract. He can't go to, you know, picture your favorite sandwich shop in Detroit, or, you know, your favorite corner bar or whatever. He can't go to those places and have the experience that is meant to be had there. Because when he goes to those places, it's going to be about him. Because of who he is, because of how many people know who he is. So fame and celebrity actually destroy the truth of the human experience for so many people. And that's a major price to pay. A lot of people think that they want that. But then I would ask somebody to consider, well, what, imagine life where you no longer can go anywhere without being recognized. You no longer have the ability to sit in your favorite coffee shop and enjoy it for what it is. Right now, you identify your favorite coffee shop, and it's good because you sit there and people aren't constantly coming up to you wanting something from you. They don't know who you are. Mm-hmm. You're getting the same cup of coffee that everyone else is getting. And when you have fame, and I mean big time fame, like David Lynch or more fame, you all of a sudden give up access to day-to-day life in the way that you once knew it, and perhaps permanently so. And I would always wonder, is it worth it? I mean, a lot of people equate fame and fortune, and that's not always the case. You can have what you need to have to live a wonderful life without losing the priceless anonymity, you know, that you have today. And so I look at all of my life choices are based on thinking really intentionally about that. I like to do things that are public, and I like to engage in that way, but I would never want to tip the scale to the point where I can't live where I live, walk down the street and not be identified and known. That's critical. I want to be able to go with my wife and my daughter to the places that we love and it be about being with them, as opposed to that being taken away. And thankfully, I'm not anywhere close to that, and I don't think I ever will be. But I think about that all the time, not because I'm ever at risk of it, but because it makes me grateful for what I have, and it keeps me from pining for that indicator of success that actually would not bring about a life I want to lead.
That does it for this episode of Getting Work to Work. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. It means a lot to me that you are here. Would you be willing to share Getting Work to Work with your friends, other creative professionals, and entrepreneurs? You can send them to gwtw.co or have them search for Getting Work to Work on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and even Spotify. If you have a few minutes, would you be willing to leave me a review on Apple Podcasts, letting me know what you think of the show? You can find the link on gwtw.co/169. I really appreciate you taking the time to do that. Would you like to be a guest on a future episode of Getting Work to Work, or know someone who should be on the show? Maybe you need some advice or just want someone to say hi to. Drop me a line by sending me an email. I'm chris@chrismartinstudios.com, or you can find me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at CM Studios. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.